difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Keith Phipps
and Genevieve Kosky.
Tasha Robinson, our fourth panelist, has left early for Christmas, so we'll just have to discuss her favorite movie of the year without her. Here on the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we're looking at two bright, colorful, swoon-worthy musicals about the power of young love, but with a bittersweet twist. Genevieve, why don't you rip the Band-Aid off and tell us just what that bittersweet twist is?
The twist is, Scott, that sometimes things don't work out.
Damn it! Everyone seems so perfect together, too. So tell us about this week's pairing.
Well, it's been over half a century since the movie musical has been a regular staple of the American movie-going diet, and it's still particularly rare to see a musical written and choreographed for the screen. And it's even rarer still to encounter one as skillfully wrought as La La Land, director Damien Chazelle's splashy follow-up to Whiplash. La La Land sets the romance between Emma Stone's wannabe actress and Ryan Gosling's wannabe jazz man against a backdrop of Tinseltown at its most romantic. And yet for all the hat tips to old Hollywood favorites like Singin' in the Rain and An American in Paris, the film's love story takes a melancholy turn that recalls Jacques Demy's classic 1964 musical The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. The Umbrellas of Cherbourg has its own romantic backdrop in a coastal town of cobblestone streets lined with charming boutiques and cafes. It also features two young lovers, played by Catherine Deneuve and Nino Castelnuovo, whose plans are upended by fate. And it will also make you cry unless you are a replicant. Scott, are you a replicant?
Well, crying shorts my circuitry, so the best I can do is squint when I'm moved. But I was plenty moved by both La La Land and The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which are not only beautifully filmed, performed, and scored, but also have the courage to access deeper truths about love. We expect to feel happy after watching musicals that aren't directed by Lars von Trier. But these films are emotional experiences that leave you appreciating an ending more complicated than Happily Ever After. But we're not at the ending here yet on the Next Picture Show. We're at the beginning of our two-part episode, full of optimism about where this podcast will take us. Please wait for us after the break.
Mais je ne pourrai jamais vivre sans toi. Je ne pourrai pas, ne parle pas, j'en mourrai. Je te cache. Ce n'est pas possible.
Je ne te quitte pas.
Mon amour, il faudra pourtant que je parte. Tu sauras que moi, je ne pense qu'à toi. Mais je sais que toi, tu m'attendras.
The Umbrellas of Cherbourg is one of my favorite movies. And it's the favorite movie of our own Keith Phipps, whose wife, Stevie, arranged a private screening at the Music Box Theater in Chicago for his 40th birthday. The three of us were in attendance that night, and I've seen the film many times in my life, first discovering it when it was restored and released in the mid-1990s. And every time I've seen The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, I've come away with a slightly different feeling about it. In his essay for the Criterion edition of the film, my friend Jim Ridley, a brilliant critic for the Nashville Scene who passed away last year, encapsulates it beautifully. Jim writes, "More than any other film I know, Umbrellas affects people differently at different stages of life. When I first saw it, newly married but still remembering vividly the pang of adolescent crushes, it played as tragedy, the story of a young love snuffed out by war, fate, and economic hardship. Over the years, seen in the light of Demi's other films, it has come to seem more properly an exaltation of life's bittersweet balances and trade-offs, of unexpected triumphs made richer by the dashed hopes that offset them." We've talked often on this show about the personal experiences we bring to movies and how much they do or do not affect our reaction to them. Jim's reaction to The Umbrellas of Cherbourg mirrors mine very closely. I would have been in my mid-20s when I first saw the restored version in theaters, and I remember being crushed by it. The first of the film's three parts, which takes up half the 90-minute running time, captures the feeling of first love better than any film I've ever seen. It's possible that Guy, the mechanic played by Nino Castelnuovo, has had some experience, but we know that Genevieve, a 16-year-old played by Catherine Deneuve, has not. There's an overwhelming end-of-the-world intensity to their courtship that feels precisely right for two people for whom love is new. Genevieve's mother warns her that she's moving too fast, and not without reason, but it wouldn't be called falling in love if you weren't jumping off the cliff a little. They talk about having children. They talk about their modest but blissful future together. When Guy gets called to war in Algeria, Genevieve promises to wait for him. Je t'aime, je t'aime, je t'aime, whatnot. But in the second and third parts of the film, Guy and Genevieve drift apart. The distance between them isn't satisfyingly bridged by letters. Genevieve, who's pregnant with Guy's child, starts listening more to her mother, who convinces her that Roland Cossard, an earnest man of means, will make a good husband and father. Guy returns to Cherbourg with no one waiting for him at the train station. He's bitter and angry that Genevieve is gone, but he finds solace and happiness in Madeline, the kind young woman who's been looking after his godmother. The two get married, have a child of their own, and live in the gas station that Guy has always dreamed about owning. Guy and Genevieve don't see each other again until the very last scene, when Genevieve drives into the gas station on a snowy evening around Christmas. They haven't seen each other, and we haven't seen them together since she was bidding a tearful farewell to him at the train station at the end of part one. The first time I saw The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, a few years after the breakup of my first serious relationship, but many years before I got married, I marveled at the truth of two people who were once so madly in love regarding each other so differently. Like Jim, it struck me as tragic that a love so pure couldn't last. But now, the ending seems like, as Jim wrote, quote, an exaltation of life's bittersweet balances and trade-offs. I have yet another reading of the ending after watching it for this podcast, but the maturity and insight of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg are as indelible to me as Michel Legrand's score, which I haven't even talked about yet. But we'll talk about it and much, much more in just a moment.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So, Keith and Genevieve, I guess to start, I mean, what has been your experience with The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and do you feel your perspective on it has changed over time, as Jim suggests?
You know, I think I saw it about the same point in my life as you, mid-20s. I think it was re-released in theaters in the 1996. I remember the marquee in Madison, Wisconsin had Cherbourg with an H at the end, as if it were Pittsburgh. But, you know, I think I recognized that the ending was measured at the time, but it's not really, you know, something I necessarily understood. And later on, as a married person, you kind of do understand that it's not an unhappy ending. It's not an unambiguously happy ending either, but the bittersweetness is its own kind of wonderful feeling in this. And you know, sort of the bittersweet verging on happiness is usually, that's a comfortable place for me to be in my life. Ecstatic happiness maybe is not something that we get to experience that much as grown-ups, but sort of the wise understanding that life has worked out better than perhaps than you ever could have dreamed it was, even if all your dreams didn't come true. That's a good place to be.
Well, and I mean, this again, as I said in the intro, is your favorite film, or
it is.
Yeah, and so how did that come to be? What are the qualities, I suppose, of this film that are so special to you?
It's emotionally, it's so moving. It is. I was watching the making of documentary on the Criterion Blu-ray today, and Demi talks about how he wanted to make a movie that made people cry, and he made a movie that made people cry. But I also feel like it's so much of what you want from movies here. It's this totally immersive experience where everything is working. The camera movements, the look of it, the beautiful colors, the music. I mean, it's just enveloping from the moment you start it. And the spell never breaks. I mean, just carries through. There's not a moment in this movie that doesn't work for me. I think every act is wonderful in its own way. The bookends, the first and third acts are both packed such an emotional wallop. It gets me everything I wanted from a movie. You know, it was. There's a handful of movies I can point to and say that were just sort of revelatory. And if they didn't change the way I looked at movies, at least sort of explain to me what I wanted when I went into a movie theater. And this is far and away at the top of the list for me.
Genevieve, what about you?
Well, my first time seeing it was at Keith's birthday, so an undisclosed number of years ago.
20 years ago.
Yeah.
I retire next week, guys.
Old man Phipps over here. No, but I mean, I was an adult at that point. I was well past the stage that he and Genevieve are when the film begins. So, like, I was pretty far removed, I think, from the sort of, like, wide-eyed, idealistic love that first part really encapsulates. And it was something that I was able to appreciate because of all the things Keith is talking about in terms of the cinematic aspect of it and just kind of firing on all cylinders as far as what film can do emotionally. But personally, I responded more to the bittersweet ending. Even at that point, the first time I saw it, partially I was primed for it because I knew Keith's opinion of this film and I kind of had an idea of why he liked it. So I was going into it prepared for that. So perhaps I didn't have the gut punch moment, but I really, really loved that ending the first time I saw it. And the second time I saw it, which was in preparation for this podcast, which I watched with my family, which was a lovely experience and kind of allowed me to appreciate the more classic film elements of it this time around.
I'll confess actually to not actually watching the whole thing this time. It's like the bourbon that you leave. It's only there for special occasions, you know. it's such a powerful film. So I watched the supplements around this and learned some stuff I didn't know.
That first part still gets to me. I think there's a purity to that feeling that experience teaches you to lose a little bit of this feeling like what you have is so perfect and great and untarnished by anything. And of course, we can talk about having children. And of course, I'm going to wait for you when you're to war. And of course, I'm going to say goodbye to you in the manner that I do at the train station. Mm-hmm. And you just are so caught up in that. And for me, again, speaking personally, it just brought up such a strong memory of feelings that I used to have that are really in the past, you really can't access anymore, you know, when you move on and love takes a different form, I guess.
Yeah, but movies can get you there. And also, as many times as I've seen this movie, you know, I know where it's going. Maybe even the first time you see this movie, you know where it's going, but they don't know it. And that train scene is just so powerful, but they don't know it. And they're so caught up in the moment. And every time, one of the great moments in movies, period, in my opinion.
So what do you make of the setting of this film? It's so memorable. You know, how does it add to the film? And what, you know, what does it tell you about, I guess, the lives that these characters lead?
Well, it explains the necessity for an umbrella store, I guess, being a coastal town with weather that changes quickly. Mm-hmm. But I think that weather is also a handy metaphor for how emotions can change unexpectedly.
It can add instant drama with the rain and having no rain. But and it's got kind of a working class feel to it too, mm-hmm. even though it's been romanticized and it's in this bright colors.
Well, it's Cherbourg. They filmed there. They dressed it up, obviously, a lot for this, but it's actually shot on location.
Yeah, and I mean, there are definitely some like shabby looking alleyways. I don't want to say shabby looking because it's so like beautifully rendered, but like, I mean, this is a place that's lived in. This is, you know, mm-hmm. old. This is not shiny Hollywood backlot version of Cherbourg.
Or if it is, it's like the backlots for West Side Story or something where there's some grime there as well.
Yeah.
I think there's also, you know, an economic aspect to this as well. And, you know, and this is where I guess Genevieve's mother comes in. You know, her business is struggling. You know, she certainly doesn't want her daughter to struggle. And so she's looking at this relationship she's having with a mechanic askance for multiple reasons, one of which is that she doesn't necessarily see him being able to provide for her in the same way that she does this jeweler, Roland Cassard, who comes around later. So that's a motivating factor, but that's also, of course, something you don't think about when you're a young person. You know, you think about, oh, we're just going to live this modest lifestyle. Mm-hmm. He's going to be a mechanic, and we'll have this little home, and, you know, it's not going to be much, but we'll have each other. And, you know, that's a young person's way of thinking.
And you can't hear your parents at that age either. And I think Genevieve is very much in that place where she can't hear. And I think that's another shift. I think you, I don't know if you necessarily come around to the mom's way of thinking as you get older, but you see where she's coming from more. I think you judge her pragmatism a little less. And in the end, she's there. She has the plan, and it actually works out in a way. We'll get to that.
In a way, yeah. That was the thing I was kind of puzzling over. on this viewing just how much things actually do or do not work out for mm-hmm. her, because I think it's a little bit of a different story than it is for him.
But, well, she's in mourning when we see her at the end, and she's in mourning for her mother is what we're told. But the fact that she is in black and just such a stark figure, there's hints that she is unhappy beyond the fact that her mother just died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too.
And she just leaves her child in the car.
Yeah.
after remarking about how cold it is.
Yeah.
And the fact that we do not see her husband, we don't see Roland, we have no way to judge how they are together. It almost wants to take Yi's side of judging her a little bit much, a little too much, perhaps.
It does. I think
there's a little bit of working class romanticism there too. That you know, that maybe she sold out.
Yeah, and I mean, I think though it's a little bit nuanced in the sense that you know Roland is by no means a bad guy.
No,
and he's a perfectly decent guy, it would appear. But then you get her at the wedding, and that's not a happy bride. Yeah. You know, it's this very lavish wedding, but she doesn't really seem all that happy to be there. And maybe that comes through a little bit more at the end, whereas Guy gets everything he could possibly want. He's got the Esso station that is apparently located in the middle of a snow globe. And he's got a child who's seems very bright, and things work out for him a little bit more than they do for her, which I don't necessarily think the film is judgmental about it, but at the same time, not a lot of time passes between when he goes off to war and when she makes the decision to accept Guy's proposal.
She's also pregnant. I mean, you know,
she is pregnant, yeah. But that's still pretty fast, right?
And it's unclear to me still after having watched this twice, like who is quote unquote at fault as far as the letters are concerned, like who is not writing enough versus whose expectations of letters are too high. And it's do you guys have a take on that? Because I know there's one line like one letter in 2 months or two letters in 1 month, something like that.
Yeah. And he remarks about her letters have seen more distance.
It's like she's upset about the quantity of the letters and he's upset about the quality of the letters. But I think it is supposed to be a little ambiguous about maybe who is at fault in terms of letting the communication lapse.
It's worth noting also that Roland is from the Demi shared universe, I guess.
Yeah.
He's in his first feature film called Lola, in which he has his heart broken by the title character, by Anouk Ami. So he's already kind of been through what Genevieve and Guy are going through. So if you've seen that film, and it's quite good, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but if you've seen that film, it brings in a little bit of extra information you might not have if you're just watching this one.
And so that really lovely sequence in the second act where he is singing about some past, you know, romantic memory, mm-hmm. that is of that relationship.
Yeah, it is. And I'm sure I'm butchering the name. It's set in Nantes, which is where Jacques Demy is from. And that's where the film was set as well.
And that's a really nice sequence, too, in that you were flashing back to another time and place, but not to any people. It's just a space mm-hmm. that the camera kind of wanders around in while he sings and recalls this relationship. It's a lovely piece of filmmaking because, you know, most of the time, you know, when people are singing, we are watching them sing. So to kind of break away from that and go to another place and get a sense of who Roland is and what his romantic history is and where he is coming from, it's a really nice way to do it. And the thing about the musical in general about this movie is that I think it really creates four pretty rich characters, maybe even five if you want to include Madeline in this, without having the time that it would normally take another film to be able to accomplish what it does. I think you can talk about these relationships as being complex and full of nuance and complicated feeling, but the film establishes all that so economically. There's just no wasted moments in the film.
Yeah, and I think part of that is it's an advantage of being a musical where you can kind of take shortcuts to those emotions.
Well, and particularly this style of musical,
right,
where it is sung through. I mean, it's opera. I mean, opera is... Mm-hmm.
It's jazz opera, basically.
Yeah, yeah. They talk about opera at the beginning about, you know, I prefer movies to opera or whatever. Like, but it is specifically called out as a touchstone here. But I think like what it takes from the operatic style is the notes express the emotion, not the words. Just like the way Je T'aime is sung and the emotion that is behind it and the way the notes are drawn out, like that tells you as much as two pages of dialogue could, mm-hmm. you know, and that's just kind of the advantage of the style that's being utilized here.
Yeah, Anne Vernon, who plays the mother, talks about how receiving the screenplay, she says, this is so simplistic. This is, yeah. this is yeah. no, there's nothing to this. It's really Not a complicated thing at all. I was skeptical about it. And then, you know, when you see it all put together.
Yeah. I mean, most of the best love songs are pretty simple, mm-hmm. you know, like, or a lot of them, I should say.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of one of our old Next Picture Show films, which is, you know, Memento.
That's not the movie I was expecting you to call out right now.
But I mean, just like if
it's
you,
so much like Memento.
If people talk about, you know, if you straighten out Memento and you can watch, I guess, I have not done so, but if you can watch on the old DVD a chronological version of Memento, it's just it's as simple as can be, but the way of course that it's he structures it makes it complex, and in the sense that somewhat analogous here of being able to accomplish a lot without doing too much. I guess one of the other things I appreciated too about the music, you know, you have all this dialogue that is sung, and sometimes it's about things as inconsequential as haggling over the billing at a mechanic shop. But then, you know, when it does hit you, when you get to a big number like "I Will Wait for You," and you don't even—I wouldn't even call it a big number in the sense like it's not like a song necessarily. Mm-hmm. But when you hear that, you know, that big sweeping passage and the score, it just it stands out all the more and just it delivers kind of that emotional punch that the film is, you know, looking for.
I think that's also a function of it being sung through like this is it nothing against traditional musicals, but the film doesn't stop for a big musical number. It's like all of a sudden, you know, you're turning up the temperature on the water until you realize that you're in the middle of a big musical number, you know?
Just having it sung through, I think another benefit is like you're literally like along for the ride the entire movie. Like, you know, there's the music kind of forms this emotional continuum that you stay on throughout the whole movie. You know, there's no break to go to, like you said, a big number. It's very effective here. It probably would not be effective in all musicals, but it is here.
Yeah, it's enchanting. I mean, it kind of
that's a good word.
It's enchanting, and the fact of it is that when people sing how they feel to each other, it's just more powerful than when they talk about how they feel about one another a lot of the time, you know?
Going back to what you said a few minutes ago about the nuance of these characters and their relationships, how do you guys read the relationship between Genevieve and her mother? Because I read it differently the second time around, and I'm curious.
I think as someone who doesn't want, well, I think like with all parents, they don't want their kids to make the same mistakes they did. They want to have a better life for their kids than they had. And I think it's a little overbearing, but I think that her intentions are good, even if she can be a little misguided as to how she implements them.
Yeah, that is how I viewed it the first time. This time around, I was like picking up notes of jealousy toward her daughter that I thought made that relationship and her ending up with Roland a little more interesting. Like there's the whole bit at the beginning with her having to sell her jewels and saying how she like feels stripped and naked. And there's just something about that character where you get the sense that she is like mourning her youth or her lost beauty or youth, whatever, you know, that's a pretty standard older woman character emotion to have. Mm-hmm. But in that scene where Roland comes to dinner and asks Genevieve's mother about marrying her, like she's taken aback. And I originally took that reaction to just mean basically what she says, like, oh, she's so young. But one of the people I was watching it with took it to mean that Genevieve's mother was expecting or was hoping that she would form a relationship with Roland and that he would be her savior. And she's kind of taken aback by how Genevieve has like taken that role from her. And there are like little instances of her mother kind of like negging her, you know, saying, you know, she's not that pretty and stuff. I'd honestly have to go back and watch it really with that in mind. But I think that is an interesting reading of that relationship.
I don't think her intentions are as pure as I want the best for my daughter.
Right.
Because she starts, Roland comes onto the scene because she is desperate and needs money and her business is failing, you know, and so all of that kind of gets mixed up with, you know, whatever it is best for her daughter on top of, you know, what you said, which seems perfectly valid about her sense of lost youth or
jealousy.
I mean
that's like not a particularly uncommon mother-daughter relationship to plumb in movies, sort of the jealousy of the older mother toward the younger daughter.
I don't think it's either or either. Yeah, I think those feelings can overlap pretty easily.
Yeah.
We can maybe talk about Madeline just a little bit. How do you feel about her compared to Roland? And does the film feel, you said the word judgmental, does the film feel that Guy is entitled to the bitterness that he feels about Genevieve not waiting for him to come back?
Well, I think he's punished for that bitterness. In the before he marries Madeline, we see him kind of lose it, and he loses his job, he's not shaving, you know, and he spends a night with a prostitute who named Jenny, very close to Genevieve,
yeah.
Brunette. But, you know, I think there's definitely an intentional echo happening there. And while he is with this prostitute, like, wallowing in that bitterness, his godmother dies, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that is there's definitely a trope of being punished for sex in films, and I think like that is definitely what is happening there. And so I think Madeline appearing at that moment is kind of a redemption moment for him. Mm-hmm. That's how I rate it.
Yeah, she's certainly there for him at the point where his character needs him, not necessarily in a way that mm-hmm. makes sense for her own character as much as she's defined. I mean, not a knock on the film, but
no, I mean, so, you can only do so much. Right.
Yeah. It's a short film.
It is a short film.
Yep.
You know, one thing I actually did want to mention about the setting, we went over before, but I'd forgotten about it until now, is one of the things I love about the movie is how it returns to the same spaces in a different context mm-hmm. in wonderful ways. I mean, the prominent example being the train station in which she bids him farewell. He returns to it, and of course it's pouring and nobody's there for him. There's a scene in the cafe when he comes back where he's by himself and he looks straight across, and there is the table that they sat in where they were sort of, you know, declaring their undying love for each other. You know, there's the scene, the same dock area where Guy and Genevieve are talking about their future and about having children is the same place where she goes with Roland and has the same conversation. So all these settings, they have different meanings. They take on different meanings as the film gives them new contexts, I guess.
I have another one. He goes back to the umbrella shop, which is no longer the umbrella shop. It's being turned into a laundrette. And when we see the umbrella shop, it is the most colorful place in the world. And when he returns and it's becoming a laundrette, it is white. There is no color to be seen in that shop at all.
This ultimately a movie about diversifying the stock of your store and not specializing in two nation area?
I mean, if you can't make an umbrella store work in Cherbourg, where can you make an umbrella shop work?
Yeah.
It reminded me a little bit of In the Mood for Love, like sort of the scene when he returns the apartment. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that's... That is very much a you know, the cliche, you can't go home again, but it's true. You know, you go back and the place you grew up in is not the place you grew up in anymore. I think there's a little bit of that too, especially if you have powerful emotional experiences tied to a place and you go back and whoever you had those with or the people that were there before are gone, the place can seem kind of haunted and distant.
That's Manchester by the Sea.
Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
If you want to talk about that, it was just that returning and sure. everything looking different to you. I mean, obviously the level of trauma is significantly higher in that movie, but I think the movie's very the Umbrella is very smart about the way it uses and then reuses these same spaces.
Well, speaking of trauma, I mean, Guy goes to war, you know, he returns with a limp, like, you know, he presumably had some traumatic experiences while he was away, and I think it's fair to say that beyond Genevieve not being there, perhaps being at war and what he saw at war kind of informs how he is seeing this town when he returns.
And this is not an overtly political film, but you can't take them out. I mean, this is the war in Algeria, which is just freshly concluded. And like, this is a movie about how, you know, the bittersweet and young love doesn't always work out and you find a more mature love on and on. But it's also a film about war messes things up for people.
Yeah.
War takes them away. And whatever course their relationship might have run is completely split in two by him being called to fight.
Right. And even in the scenario in which she does wait for him, does he come back changed?
Yeah.
Such a changed person that they can't, that relationship can't work. I mean, has he now reached a stage where Madeline is more appropriate for who he is? Maybe she has a depth. I mean, she's a caretaker, you know?
She allows him to have the life that he envisioned for himself with Genevieve, but Madeline will work in a pinch.
I know. At least she recognizes that. It's like, are you really, you know, am I just kind of...
I mean, you're not going to convince me that Genevieve's are not superior, so, you know.
You know, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg was a hit in France, but it took flack for some critics at home and abroad because Demi wasn't really part of the French New Wave that was radicalizing cinema at the time. The film was dismissed often as a curio, sort of odd and silly. Is there something to the musical form itself that makes it difficult for us to accept them as substantive? I mean, is there just a reaction to this genre that maybe takes us a little more time to kind of see these films as being worth what they are?
Well, I mean, there's the specifics of the time, too. This was not someone who was going to completely overturn the traditional quality of filmmaking in France. I mean, he was very friendly, obviously, with the French New Wave people. And I think he's kind of recognized now as the figure of the French New Wave. And I think Lola is a lot more New Wavy than this. But I mean, this is very much, as innovative as it is, it's also very much rooted in its traditional musicals. Yeah, he's kind of neither here nor there in some ways.
Yeah, he was kind of between worlds. When did he marry Agnes Varda? When did that happen?
They were married at this point, I believe. And interestingly, she was a single mother, too, so that might have found its way into the film. Hmm. And not to keep going back to the making of, but on the making of, she talks about how he died in 1990. Varda is still alive. We actually just saw her last year at the Music Box here.
Yeah, she's unbelievable.
She's so awesome. She's such an awesome interviewer. She's like, yeah, I used to think that maybe this is inspired by some tragic lost love that he experienced, but no, I don't think so.
she's remarkable.
I hope she lives to be 150.
One other thing, too, about it, the appreciation of this film and Demi in general, you know, Jim Ridley in that essay, he's such a great writer. And I have to bring this up because it's so beautifully phrased and I'll never forget it. He talks about how Demi's films were kind of disrespected because of the, quote, the aesthetic abattoir of lop and chop VHS is the way he described it, which is just a beautiful Jim Ridley phrase. And that's true. I think if you have films like Demi's that are full of color and life, those are not films that are necessarily going to be well treated and poorly transferred VHS copies.
As much as I was happy to grow up in the video store era, I think of films that just literally made no sense in pan and scan. Like, first time I tried to watch a Sergio Leone movie.
Oh my gosh, how do we do it?
I know. And I'm glad the first time seeing this for me was on the big screen.
We're just basically just completely diverging here, but I have this memory of trying to see Once Upon a Time in the West for the first time because it was something that you could not see anywhere. And I was super excited and it was on cable and I taped it or something like that. And I started watching it, and it was letterboxed, and I was really excited about it. And, you know, you go through that opening credit sequence, which is one of my favorite sequences ever. And then the credits end, and you cut, and then it goes to pan and scan. And I can remember just being this given some sort of horrible audible response to that. And my mother just laughing at me.
It was like
whatever the bellicose
Scott,
version of
Scott Tobias, noise of disgust.
Me is like a 17-year-old going, blah. And my mom just laughing at me. She's just like rubbing in my face, which is not the right thing to do.
Come on, but, Scott's mom.
Come on. She's better now. She wouldn't laugh at me. But now you get a nice Criterion box set, and you can appreciate him as being an artist on a level with the New Wave directors, who of which that scene was kind of in between worlds. So it's nice that this film, you know, has been accepted and embraced for, you know, the masterpiece that I think it plainly is. But before we wrap up, I kind of wanted to ask the two of you if you have any favorite moments from the film or things that stood out for you this time.
I was happy in the first scene. I love the singing of the most mundane interactions at the mechanics. Just like, oh, okay, this is a movie. This is definitely a different kind of movie. And I've said before, I mean, the ending is so amazing, and the train station scene is so just breathtaking.
I think that the train station is probably the shot that sticks with me most, just the pulling away and watching Genevieve kind of disappear into the distance. But honestly, when I think of this film, the first thing that pops in my mind is wallpaper. Just the wallpaper. I mean, this is a colorful movie, which obviously I love. Oh, and let me back up. Also, just the opening credits, the overhead shot of the crisscrossing umbrellas. It's just, it's such a lovely opening card to the movie. But after watching this movie, I really want to just wallpaper my whole house and dress to match the wallpaper, because it's my favorite part.
I like that. Yeah, that opening is really cool, too, because it's one of the few bits of like choreography in the film. Yeah. The film is choreographed in the movement. There's
dancing, though.
I like the movement. There's no dancing. It's just everyone moves carries themselves gracefully, and I think that's kind of enough for the film. But
it's blocking, not choreography.
It is. It becomes choreography if you can move that nicely. But yeah, I think it's just, I'm still in love with the big emotional moments in the film. From the moment he informs Genevieve that he's going into the service through to the train station, that stretch of film, and then of course the end of the movie is just so bittersweet, and I just have never experienced anything like that, quite what it evokes. I think the film is just wise about love in a way that almost no film I've seen is, that it understands the different forms that it can take, and it's incredible to return to it and have that evoked. You know, it's also so wonderful to see, you know, how it changes and becomes something else at the end of the film, and how that makes you feel, and you know, how enriching that can be to have this dream really of his be realized. I mean, it's a sadder scene than I acknowledged or realized for Genevieve, who I think you could argue has a less happy ending than Guy, certainly a less happy ending than Guy. How much less happy, we don't really know, but
no. It becomes a film from his perspective in the final moments, and in a way that it hasn't been up till then.
Yeah, which is kind of a strange choice, isn't it? Because she's kind of the one we follow for the most part.
No, I mean, from the time he returns from war, I mean, we're pretty solidly in his perspective. Like, we don't see Genevieve once she's married until that last scene. Like, she's absent for the film for, I'd say, close to a third of it.
So, yeah, maybe, yeah, I guess you're right. And of course, he's...
I mean, her presence hangs heavy over the film.
You know,
but,
and then, of course, he's absent for the second act. And he comes back and she's not there waiting for him. But anyway...
So surprising no one, Scott likes the saddest parts of the movie.
I do. I love to just kind of marinate in sad stuff. That's my thing. I never understood that. My own wife resists films that have some sadness or a lot of sadness to them. And to me, it's just like, bring it on. It's just like, the sadder a film can make me, the more like genuine emotion it can draw out. Like, I'm going to be all about that film.
Well, there's more sadness on the horizon in our next episode, so.
Okay, well, we'll be right back with some listener feedback on our last episode. Now it's time for feedback. We thought we were through with Arrival, but Arrival isn't through with our listeners. We continue to get thoughtful emails pouring over the twists and turns of the film, and we have another one to share from a listener who was let down by the big reveal. Keith, do you want to take this one for us?
Sure. I feel like Arrival is going to be the next Inception, where it's going to be chewed over by the internet for a while. So Blake writes, like Tasha and Genevieve, I enjoyed Arrival overall, but felt the emotional climax to be inert. I appreciate what the film aimed for with its ambitious elliptical structure, but in order to make the surprise of the prologue as epilogue work, you have to undermine the emotional terrain the film built up beforehand. While I can understand that the Heptapod's language allows Louise to experience all time at once, she has had no contact with the aliens at the beginning, which makes the emotional recess of her loss feel doubly duplicitous. Before the reveal, I found Arrival to have expertly crafted the emotional and intellectual spheres of the film and intertwined them with the visuals. The black monolith of the alien ship is shot in relief of Louise in multiple scenes. Its inscrutable shape in the background suggests a loss in her past, or so we would assume. It is shot this way merely to suggest this. The film constructs emotional capital with the sole errand of defaulting on it. That's the twist. I think there's some merit in how the story invites us to examine the structure of cinematic language by subverting our reliance on it. In this way, we can adopt Louise's and ultimately the movie's nonlinear perspective of time and tragedy. I understand this intellectually in the context of the benefits of the alien language and the larger message, but the fate of the child could no longer strike me, and Louise's future choices lost their weight. Are we to assume the film was always to be interpreted in the Heptapod's language, even though we necessarily read it linearly? Hearing from others who have read the story and saw the movie, the story perhaps ironically works better in the medium it was originally fashioned in, as text.
I really wish one of us had read the story.
I had it out from the library, and then it was overdue. I had to return it.
We should do like a separate, you know, mini podcast about that whole experience, Keith, of being out from the library and not reading it and then having it be overdue.
But I think I read it in some point in the future. I read it, so I felt like I was kind of reacting.
Okay, so
to
tell
it.
So tell us what he means then. Ask your future self.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this is one of those movies where every time people say they weren't moved by it, they didn't get to them, like, I can't wait to tell you. This movie just
sucks for you.
This movie just was like an apple core and just removing the center of my being for the 2 hours it was running. And I think he's right, though. I think you do kind of have to. I think it is to be read in heptapodies or whatever. I think it is a film that's richer if you kind of let it work it that way, where it's kind of all experiences at once. I don't know. I think in some ways I knew there was a twist when I saw this movie. I said this in the episode itself. I knew there was something, and I figured it out fairly early. And once I figured out what was going on, that's when it really kicked in for me. So maybe the ideal way to see this is to have someone whisper it in your ear halfway through or something if you're not figuring it out for yourself. I'm not sure. It works for me.
Yeah, I mean,
sorry, Blake.
I think I said this on the episode. Like, I wish that I felt the emotional connection you guys felt to this film, because I mean, I always want to like a film as much as possible, and when I don't, it makes me sad. But I like what Blake says in his letter about the film constructing emotional capital with the sole errand of defaulting on it. I think that's a very good expression of what I was fumbling toward in that episode of kind of feeling that the movie tricked me, you know, and setting up an emotional scenario that it ended up kind of pulling out from under you. So I think that's just kind of a good expression of maybe the underlying frustration myself and many other people felt with the twist.
Just as a side note, I don't like it when our readers' writing is this kind of feeling like it kind of is getting in my territory a little bit. And I'm suspicious of it, but
don't like that's level we want.
Exactly. We want like things that we can kind of go in and copy edit and then present.
That's not true. Keep being smart. Keep sending us smart letters.
I know. You know, this is an ironic tone I'm trying to strike here. But my issue, I'm not someone who gets too hung up, or I try not to get too hung up on plot and logic and everything kind of making sense. If it makes emotional sense and if I kind of key into the intentionality of it and the feeling of it, that's fine for me. If I feel like, you know, I'm just not the type to see it as a cheat that maybe we're supposed to interpret the film in the heptapod's language. I mean, that's not the type of thing that becomes a sticking point for me when I watch a film like this. But that's just my point of view. I think for others, maybe not so much. So moving on to our last show on Mulan and Moana, a listener weighs in on the thorny issue of Disney's animal sidekicks. Hey, Genevieve.
Hey.
You take this one.
Sure. Anthony Pizzo writes, "You all spoke a little bit about the changing nature of Disney animal sidekicks, and I think I have more to add. Not only has Disney been moving away from talking animal sidekicks, but in each animated musical since Tangled, they have deliberately supplanted and subverted the dominant animal sidekick of the previous film. In Frozen, Hans's horse is a dead ringer for Maximus, both in design and temperament. He's intelligent, severe, and feels superior to the humans who ride him. However, he is quickly abandoned, or rather abandons Anna, and we are given over to Sven, a big dopey dog of a reindeer, who has most of his humanistic characteristics projected onto him by Kristoff. Then in Moana, we have the dog-like pig Pua, who is literally left behind in favor of Heihei, a fairly authentic chicken. How appropriate for a movie so concerned with themes of identity." I like that he interprets his Heihei as being authentic. I mean Heihei is who he is. I mean, I think that's a interesting observation. It's only tracks over a handful of films, so you know, I don't know if it's a pattern or a coincidence, but I do think there is something to the idea of a secondary sidekick taking over for the figure you would presume to be the main sidekick, particularly in more recent Disney films.
It's more to merchandise that way too.
Yeah, that's right.
I've been to Toys R Us this season, everybody. There's lots of Moana stuff, you know, in all of these cases. I think they've just figured it out a little bit. There's been more of an evolution, more of a limited but effective comic role for these sidekicks. They're not as dominant. We don't get too many bits of business. And I really like the pig. As I said in the previous show, and would have wanted to see more of the pig, but not a really good seafaring pig.
Well, I think back to something like Little Mermaid, where you had three separate sidekicks who are all pretty equally weighted. You had Flounder, Sebastian, and Scuttle, right?
Scuttle's the bird.
Yeah. I mean, the sidekicks are kind of like what you think of when you think of The Little Mermaid, or at least it's what I think of. Like, they do kind of overtake that film to a certain extent. So I think, especially Moana, there's a really good balance of sidekicks. I mean, I guess you can interpret Maui as a sidekick, but he's more of kind of like a co-protagonist in a way.
So. He's a demigod.
He lives and learns over the course of the
film. Yeah, he has an arc. Yeah. So, I don't know. Disney's doing good things with sidekicks. Keep it up.
Yeah.
Don't keep adding them. We don't need like 4 sidekicks in the next movie.
No, not at all. So as always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response at a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. And that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In the second half, we'll bring in La La Land, which also features a love so transcendently beautiful that it's certain to last forever, right?
Right.
No?
Oh.
But at least we get a happy ending this time, right? Mm. Maybe, kind of. We'll talk it over on the other half of this podcast. Look for that later in the week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow and follow us on Twitter @nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we'll be available for tearful farewells at the Amtrak station should you need them.